This is All of It. I'm Kushan Avidar in for Allison Stewart. Happy Pi Day, everyone. March 14, 314. Nerds know. And nerds of a certain age might also remember the Magic School Bus episode where the class accidentally gets baked into a pie and learns a little something about chemistry in the kitchen along the way.
Just to make your day complete, you might get baked into a pie on a Magic School Bus.
Unlike Miss Frizzle's class, we don't need a magic bus to learn how science can make our cooking better, because we've got Arielle Johnson, who literally has a PhD in flavor. Flavor science, to be precise. She has a new book out that aims to deepen our understanding of the natural processes that comprise flavor, from the biological makeup of the ingredients to the chemical processes we use in the kitchen to the science of the brain, where taste and smell molecules are neurologically encoded into our experience of flavor. That's cool. The book is called Flavorama, A Guide to Unlocking the Art and Science of Flavor. It is available now wherever you get your books. Arielle, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Absolutely. And listeners, we want to have you as part of the conversation too. We can take your kitchen science questions. Maybe there's a technique you want to perfect with the help of science, or maybe you want to understand why certain combos of flavors do what they do. Call or text us. Here's the number, 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Or if you have any other questions for flavor scientist Arielle Johnson, whose new book is called Flavorama, A Guide to Unlocking the Art and Science of Flavor, hit us up. 212-433-9692. Okay, Arielle, you're a flavor scientist. It's a pretty unique job title. How'd you wind up on that path?
Well, so I was, the short version, always very interested in both food and science, eventually figured out that there was a lot of science behind, you know, not only industrial food, but also cuisine and gastronomy. And you could use chemistry to learn a lot about those things. So ended up going to UC Davis in Davis, California, in the wine department, specializing in flavor chemistry. So doing a lot of chemistry, sensory analysis, modeling of things. And since then, you know, I do a lot of work with restaurants on research and development and experimentation. So making a lot of flavors with fermentation and other stuff. And at this point, there's so many bits of science that I work on that I just say flavor scientist.
Do you remember the first food in your life where you thought that flavor will stick with me forever? Wow, I want to learn more about that flavor.
It was definitely the smell of coffee, specifically coffee beans. When I was about 3 years old, I would start taking the coffee beans out of the shopping bag on the way home from the grocery store and like smelling it really deeply. I was disappointed that brewed coffee didn't taste exactly like that smell, but it definitely piqued my interest in coffee, which I still am interested in.
And now you have written a book and there are recipes in the book. It looks and feels like a cookbook, but it's not really a cookbook. How do you advise people to use this book?
I would say it can be used as a cookbook. It can be used as a reference book. If you're interested in understanding sort of the generals of how flavor works and how knowing about the science of flavor can apply to cooking at all, just flip through it. And there's a lot of sort of shorter pieces of information that'll like hook you in, even if you're not a cook. If you are a cook, I would recommend thinking about flavors, tastes, smells that you like. And there's a whole section that's almost a field guide to all of those flavors. So that's a good place to start to understand, like, what is sourness? What is an acid? Where can I find sourness?
Well, you know, it's funny because those questions kind of lie at the very science of how taste and flavor works. So help us understand the sense of taste and the sense of smell. How do they combine together to create our sense of flavor?
So when we say flavor is taste and smell, usually to the, you know, if you're taking a bite of an apple, what you feel as flavor feels like it's just taste. Smell is actually a very big part of that. And that's not actually sniffing the apple before you bite it, although that is, you know, a little bit. You can actually smell food in your mouth as you're chewing it. We call that retronasal olfaction. And it is responsible for pretty much everything about flavor beyond sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami. So fruitiness, roastiness, floral flavors, that all comes from smell. So taste comes from taste buds on your tongue. That gets routed into the brain. Smell gets routed a slightly different route into the brain, and eventually they come together in the orbitofrontal cortex, where we can recognize them not just as tastes and smells, but as like unified flavors, and then come up with descriptions and names for them.
You mentioned that they get routed differently. Is there a special reason behind that, why that routing is different?
It's just a it's a physical question, actually. Most of our senses pass through the brain stem and through sort of like the quote unquote lower parts of the brain before they get to emotions and thoughts. Smell is actually sensed directly with brain cells, that one side is anchored in your brain, one side passes into your nasal cavity, your nose, the inside. And that, rather than going through the brainstem, goes right into the emotional centers of our limbic system, especially our amygdala. So, you know, the Proustian story of dipping a Madeleine in tea.
You stole my next question.
Oh, sorry,
it's
sorry.
Okay. It's okay.
It is biologically and neurologically true and valid. That is exactly what happens. In fact, you'll often have an emotional connection or like a memory of a flavor before you can even recognize what it is.
We were literally going to bring up Proust, and then you beat us to it. So, you know, prescient.
Sorry,
you know,
about that.
Senses are all tingling. Your spidey sense is on. We have Stephanie in Greenpoint with a question. Hi, Stephanie. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
What's your question?
I like to make fermented loaf without using much wheat. And I would like to know, for one thing, why things get tangy when you culture them. And also, what does it really do to the grains or to the, you know, chickpea flour or barley or whatever when you ferment it? And then any other thoughts about, you know, fermented foods and how your body senses them would be interesting.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Great. Well, so when we're talking about culturing, for example, making sourdough or even yogurt or sauerkraut, we're talking about food that becomes sour, and the way that it gets sour is through the fermentation action of lactic acid bacteria. So these are bacteria that also live in our skin and all over different surfaces that will eat small amounts of sugars in whatever you're fermenting them in and convert that into lactic acid, which is both deliciously tangy and conveniently is fairly toxic to mold and spoilage organisms. So we get this like double bonus of delicious sourness as well as like improved food safety.
If you're just joining us, this is All of It. We are talking to Ariel Johnson, a food scientist and co-founder of Noma's Fermentation Lab, just put out a new book, Flavorama, A Guide to Unlocking the Art and Science of Flavor. We have a text that I'd love to read. Any unexpected food combinations or tastes that pair well scientifically, but most people don't think of? And what about their chemistry makes them work? Great text. Thank you for it.
I would say the number one weird flavor pairing that makes chemical and scientific sense is salt on grapefruit, or more generally, salty and bitter together. You know, generally, if your coffee is too bitter, you might add more sugar to it or try to dilute it to kind of like cover up the taste. You wouldn't necessarily think to add salt, except salt will actually interfere with the bitter receptor on the surface of the tongue and make it less effective at sensing bitterness. And sort of the kind of effect of this, if you put salt on a piece of bitter grapefruit, the grapefruit will actually taste sweeter in addition to being saltier.
So we're talking about taste buds as well right now. There's a common misconception about how taste buds are laid out on our tongues. So where did this wrong belief come from that there is a sweet zone and a salty zone and a bitter zone on everyone's tongue? And what's the reality?
So, there's this common graphic shows sort of areas of the tongue like a map. That, I believe, was published. I know it was a textbook. I think it may have been a nursing textbook, just as an explanation of these are tastes, these are where they're on the tongue. And I think the kind of, you know, attractiveness of that very graphic image with colors and zones made it catch on. And so now there's this belief that, you know, we only have sour taste buds on one part of our tongue. We actually have all kinds of taste buds all over our tongue. They're basically just mixed together to, you know, best sense as much as possible.
And sprinkled throughout the book, you have these little micro experiments that serve more to demonstrate a concept than to provide a complete recipe. We are going to get to that right after a short break, so stick around. We are talking to Ariel Johnson, the food scientist and co-founder of Noma's Fermentation Lab. And listeners, we can take your science questions. So if you have a technique that you want to help perfect with the help of science, or maybe you want to understand why does peanut butter and jelly go together so well? Well, we've got the person here to help you out. Call or text us 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Or if you have any other questions for flavor scientist Ariel Johnson, whose new book is called Flavorama, A Guide to Unlocking the Art and Science of Flavor, give us a call. 212-433-9692. We'll be right back. This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Kushan Avidar in for Allison Stewart. We are talking to Ariel Johnson, a food scientist and co-founder of Noma's Fermentation Lab. Her book, Flavorama, A Guide to Unlocking the Art and Science of Flavor, helps you understand not just what you taste, but why it tastes and smells the way that it does. Listeners, we're taking your science questions about the kitchen. If there's a technique you want to perfect with the help of science, maybe you want to understand why certain combos of flavors do what they do, give us a call. 212-433-9692. You can also text us, 212-433-WNYC. And before the break, we were talking about these micro experiments that you were sprinkling throughout the book to help provide a demonstration of these different concepts that you want to lay out. Why do you think it's important that people go out of their way to not only understand by reading, but also by experimenting and actually experiencing?
Well, I mean, flavor is a very embodied experience. So it's, you know, one thing to read about it, but to actually use this stuff, which is quite useful in the kitchen, in your cooking, you won't really be able to tell until you actually taste it and put it in your mouth. So, you know, I didn't want to give a book with a lot of conceptual information and nowhere to apply it.
So let's get into some of these experiments. You break down the book around five laws of flavor, and for each of them, you've picked out a try this experiment. The one of them is flavor is taste and smell, which we talked about mm-hmm. earlier. What's the experiment behind that one?
The simplest one would be if you're adding lemon juice to a sauce or to a dish, don't add it until the very end. In culinary school, chefs teach this, and the reason that the instructors often give is that, it will like reduce the sourness and make it taste flat. It doesn't actually reduce the sourness at all. If you heat lemon juice, it boils away its lemony aromas. So with just the taste of lemon and very little of the smell, it doesn't come together fully in your brain, and your brain reads it as less sour and less fresh.
Interesting.
So add lemon juice at the end.
Well, let's bring it back to the listeners. We've got Sarah from Queens. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I love the show, and I'm wishing Allison a speedy recovery. I have a question for the food scientist, and it's about Buddha's Hand Citron. I recently smelled it for the first time, and I was absolutely enchanted by the smell, and I learned that there's no fruit in it. You can't eat it. You can only taste it. So I was wondering if she could explain the smell and explain why you can't eat it if it smells so good.
Sarah, thank you so much for that and for the well wishes. Yep, go ahead, Ariel.
Yeah, so a Buddha's hand is a citrus. It's a very unusual looking citrus. Instead of segments on the inside, it has sort of finger-shaped things, so it looks sort of like a lemon crossed with a squid. So, you know, as a citrus fruit in the citrus family, same sort of family as lemons and such, it has a citrusy aroma, which is a basic way of saying it, but Buddha's hand has particularly like floral, fresh lemongrass qualities, so it's sort of like an extra citrus lemon kind of smell. The reason why it's not easy to eat a Buddha's hand is if you were to cut open an orange, you could peel out the orange segments and eat those, and they would be, you know, sour and sweet and tasty. A Buddha's hand has almost no flesh and almost all pith, and pith, if you have ever accidentally eaten citrus skin, is quite bitter. There's molecules called limonids in there, and unless you are candying it or adding a lot of sugar, it's best used just as a aromatic seasoning rather than a hand fruit.
It's the pith. Let's go to Mark in Toms River. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Good, Mark. What's your question?
I wanted to ask, what exactly is it about buffalo sauce that, how it gets its name and why does it taste so good on chicken?
Mark, thanks so much. All right, so buffalo sauce. What's in it? Why does it taste so good with chicken?
Buffalo sauce does not contain buffalo. It is, in fact, from Buffalo, Buffalo, New York. And it is a pretty simple sauce of mostly hot sauce and butter, sort of, you know, but you bathe chicken wings in. What makes it so good? It's a combination of spicy and sour, as well as some pungency. So vinegar is a sour ingredient. It has acids in it. But the acetic acid that makes vinegar is also volatile. So you smell it, you get that vinegar punch and also the sourness. So that plus spicy is just a very like exciting, dynamic combination. I think one of the reasons buffalo sauce is so good on buffalo chicken is that the chicken is rich and has some, you know, melted gelatin from the collagen and a little bit fatty. And that sort of punchy, sour, pungent, spicy kick really balances it out and makes it like a bigger flavor than the sum of its parts.
And sometimes those flavors that we taste can change over the course of our lives, right? So we just got a text from a listener that's asking, why do some foods like garlic, coffee, zucchini taste terrible when I'm pregnant? That comes from Abby. Thank you, Abby.
Yeah, so a lot of those foods are also foods when some people get COVID, they lose their sense of smell, and some of them lose it for a long time. When it does eventually come back, you get this effect where everything smells terrible, but especially foods like garlic, onions, alliums, and roasted things. I know of some research that has shown those are mostly compounds containing nitrogen and sulfur, which are somewhat more likely those elements to be in things that aren't so good for us. So we use our sense of smell to find delicious things, but also to avoid dangerous things. So when you're pregnant or when you've just gained your sense of smell back, your senses are much more about protection than having a great time. So if your nose has to pick, like, what receptors do I regenerate first and what signals do I pay attention to? The ones that could be, you know, rotten food or overburnt food or something dangerous are much more urgent to know about than to smell a delicious cup of coffee.
Mm. You used a word, ilium?
Oh, allium.
Allium, what is that?
That is the botanical family that garlic and onions and leeks are in.
Wonderful.
Alliums.
Alliums. Learned something new today. Well, learned many things new today. I'll come clean about that. This is All of It. I am Kushan Avidar in for Allison Stewart. We are lucky to be talking to Ariel Johnson, who is a food scientist and co-founder of Noma's Fermentation Lab. As you can hear, listeners, we're taking your questions about kitchen science. If there's a combo of foods that you think is wonderful and you want to understand the science behind it, or if you have any other questions, call us, text us, 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Ariel, you mentioned memory before, and you mentioned Proust. For listeners who love French literature, you might be thinking about the French novelist Marcel Proust, who wrote about how the crumb of Madeleine cookie unlocked memories of his aunt. You had mentioned that before. This connection between what we eat and our memories feels so strong. Can you explain why that connection exists?
Yeah, that smell and emotions connection feels very strong because at a neurological level, it is very strong. Mm-hmm. The first place that we process smell signals in our brain, once they get written on a structure called the olfactory bulb, is the limbic system. So especially the amygdala, all of them are what we use for storing emotions, emotional memories, responses to things. So before you even perceive what a smell is or could put a name to it, you'll already be having any sort of emotional connotations and memories of the last times that you experienced that smell bubble up to the surface.
That reminds me of one of the last laws of flavor that you have in your book, which is that it can be created and transformed. How so?
Well, so flavor flavor is molecules. There are molecules that make flavor. What makes a molecule have a flavor is just if it fits in a receptor that we have, either a olfactory receptor in our nose, taste receptor on our tongue. A lot of molecules are just way too big to do that. So, you know, we can taste a glucose molecule with our sweet receptor, something like starch, which is, you know, 1,000 linked glucose molecules, way too big to fit in the receptor. So we just don't perceive it as having a flavor. But if you do some chemistry, which in the case of cooking might be browning a loaf of bread in the oven, you can change molecules. You can break them down. You can make smaller pieces. So once you're cooking, doing fermentation, anything like that, you'll be taking molecules that don't have a flavor and then chemically transforming them into new molecules that do have a flavor.
Wow. And what's the experiment in the book that helps demonstrate that?
One of the simplest and I think most delicious demonstrations of this is brown butter. So brown butter just happens when you melt butter and continue heating it until the milk solids start toasting. That flavor creation is a process called the Maillard reaction. It's amino acids meeting with sugars and creating a whole kaleidoscope of byproducts. So when you make brown butter from butter, it's delicious. But, you know, for me, I always want more. So thinking about like, okay, what's the important part of brown butter? These proteins, these amino acids, these sugars, there's actually a lot more of them in cream than in butter, since butter is mostly fat. So if you start with heavy cream, which is what you would use if you were churning milk to make butter, and heat it down until it evaporates all the way and then continue toasting what's left, you'll make a gigantic amount of super delicious brown butter.
We've got one more caller. We've got Nancy in Manhattan. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. I have a strange question. Every time I have kombucha squash, and I feel like that's the only thing that I want to eat. And that's the only thing I want to eat for like 3 or 4 days. And then I inevitably end up feeling terrible and stop for a while. And it has this addictive quality. When I went online, I thought either I'm crazy. I found a number of other people that, particularly with kombucha, have that response. I just wondered if you'd come across that.
Thank you, Nancy. What do you think?
That is so interesting. I have not come across that in the literature, although I have read a paper about tomatoes, which eventually is connected. both tomatoes and squashes are usually pretty good sources of vitamin A. There's actually like a breakdown product of vitamin A that gets created in these plants that they're called noricoprenoids. They smell like very deliciously fruity, floral, amazing. So there's like some idea that we actually use those as a signal of where we might be able to find vitamin A, because compounds similar to vitamin A that aren't vitamin A break down into things that we can like barely smell at all. So we're like very sensitive to these signs of vitamins. So I might consider thinking about whether you're getting enough vitamin A in your diet. That might be the trigger for this kind of thing.
Interesting. Possibly. Vitamin A deficiency, you're saying?
Could be.
Could be. Yeah. Well, Nancy, thank you so much for that call. You know, it's Pi Day today. What's the art and science relationship here? What's your advice for how folks can make the most out of the relationship with food, where it's an art and a science?
Well, I think like a lot of people associate science from their, you know, experience in school of like there is a right answer. And if you are too creative with it or you don't get it right, then you're wrong, which is a way that some people use science, but is definitely not innate to science. For me, you know, I tried to keep the laws of flavor fairly broad and then give specific examples because like I don't necessarily want to want to tell someone exactly how they should do things in their kitchen. I can give them suggestions, but to me, I think it's much more rewarding and exciting and fun to let my science instincts help out my cooking instincts. So, you know, both of them are ways of looking at the same thing, but giving you different kinds of insights. So in the book, there's a lot of ways, whether from my own cooking or from my time working in restaurants, that, you know, the science of flavor is very helpful and just very tasty, straightforward, not complicated or difficult.
Well, the book is Flavorama, A Guide to Unlocking the Art and Science of Flavor. The author, Ariel Johnson, is a food scientist and co-founder of Noma's Fermentation Lab. Ariel, thank you so much for joining us. It was such a pleasure.
This was amazing. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And listeners, thank you for your calls. We have something special for you to send us out. We've got They Might Be Giants singing the song Super Taster. Here it is.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.